even though I went through blood, sweat, and tears during my, you know, my devotional career, somehow or other, the conditioning was very strong. Traumas are there from childhood. The necessity of expression was there to express myself. But in once I decided to express myself, I did what George Harrison did in some of his songs. When he sings something in the way she moves, and we understand that that is a composition that is 100% spiritual, but nobody knows, it's a secret. So my songs are love songs, but they are love songs between the soul and God.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I'm joined by another renowned Vaishnava musician, author, and newly discovered friend, Javi Prabhu, also known as Helen Chester. Javi Prabhu, again, whose artistic name is Helen Chester, is one of the most influential voices in contemporary Spanish language music. Born in Israel to European parents and raised in Venezuela, his musical world was shaped by a rich blend of cultures. A gifted pianist from a very young age, Javi gradually developed a distinctive musical language marked by emotional depth and stylistic openness. His prolific international career now spans more than four decades, nearly 30 albums, and hundreds of performances, earning him a Latin Grammy and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Latin Recording Academy. Alongside his artistic journey, runs a deep spiritual path. In 1973, he was initiated by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, receiving the name Javi Das. He spent 5 years as a monk dedicated to the practice of bhakti yoga, teaching and serving in Venezuela and Colombia. Today, Javi is also a father of seven and a grandfather of eight, continuing to embody life where music, devotion, and lived experience quietly inform one another. It was a touching, friendly, loving conversation about music, about kirtan, about prayer, about community, about healing trauma by being seen, by having our existence validated by our well-wishers. We talked about fame and how to deal with that in a healthy way. We talked about, of course, Javi Prabhu's experience with Srila Prabhupada, how he met Gaudiya Vaishnavism, how he's going through his chapter as an elder, and many other considerations that I personally feel will nourish our journey, individually and collectively. So this is the Free Radical Podcast, and to support it, please feel free to subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. If you feel nourished, inspired by the conversation, like it, share your comments with all of us, and keep the conversation going. Without further ado, dear brothers, sisters, family, here is Javi Prabhu. Javi Prabhu, pleasure to have you in the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Happiness.
I feel very happy to have you today.
I'm very happy to be your guest. I have a great appreciation.
Thank you.
Your personality, your knowledge is very inspiring.
It's humbling to me, but and I cannot avoid recalling. I still recall it. That was one of those gestures that impacted me. How I first contacted you. Actually, it was you contacting me. I still recall, like 3 years ago or something. I just sent a message in my Facebook account. Saw messages that you sent me, and
You introduce yourself. Of course, I knew about you, but you humbly introduce yourself. My name is Javi. I'm a musician. I'm a devotee and this and that. And you just say then, like, I just want to let you know that you can count on me. And then if you ever need assistance or support, count on me as an ally, as a collaborator. And it was very humbling. It was kind of very heart melting. And then you say, if we have ever had the opportunity to meet in person, I look forward to that. So from that moment on, and I was really looking forward to that. And our 3D meeting happened a few months ago in Mayapur. We shared some talks, some sharing, some kirtan, some program together. And yeah, since then we've been in communication, and this episode hopefully is a natural continuation of the exchanges we've been having.
Very well.
Yeah. And I already have Dania, your daughter. Recently, I interviewed Bali, so you were one of the remaining ones in the dynasty to be present in the podcast. Anyhow, let me begin with one of the classical questions that I like to ask my guests, which is basically why you have chosen to join this conversation. I mean, just for the record, I'm not paying any of my guests, so there's no financial interest in between.
Well, because we like you, and you have an aura around your personality and your behavior that is very attractive, for a lot of us, and I'm not an exception. I am attached to kindness and to good manners, and you have both.
Attached to kindness. I will keep that one line with me. Thank you. And part of my aura is the lamp behind my back. So maybe part of my strategy to impact people. But what to do? So Javi Prabhu, if I'm not mistaken, you were already connected or immersed even in the world of music before you were immersed in the world of bhakti in this lifetime. Before talking how you fell in love with Krishna and with bhakti and with Srila Prabhupada and with so many things, let us know how you fell in love first with the piano, with music.
Well, my parents are very musical.
Okay.
They listen to classical music. They listen to Italian music, Jewish music, French music. My father was selling newspapers in the street in Paris when he was younger. Mm. So he fell in love with Charles Aznavour and so many other singers, Edith Piaf. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with classical music. In fact, that's something that I'm writing now in my memoirs, is that when I was, 4 or 5 years old, my mother used to have, you know, those 78 RPM records, uh-huh, that you put one on top of the other, and then yeah, one is finished and goes for the other one like that, and yeah, then you have that.
Yeah, right. Frying pan.
So my mother, she was in the kitchen, and she, in order to maintain me busy, she used to put this music, and since I knew 4 or 5 different composer names, you know, Bach, Beethoven, Schumann, Haydn, or some, you know, just 4 or 5 composers and musicians, I was trained to hear, because I was supposed to know the name of the composer. I never knew the name of the composer, but I had to listen to the music. So I would run after the first record and to the kitchen and say, "Mom, this is Beethoven." I says, no, it's not, but go back, listen to the next one and let me know. And like that. So my
ear training. Yeah.
Yes, my ear got got training and I got into the magic of music, not even out of my choice, but out of my mother's tactic. So, but I'm very grateful because, you know, what happened with that is that eventually music became almost an obsession. In my case, I grew up listening to music when there was no music. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
I could be laying in my bed and I could hear music. Mm-hmm. Although there was no music, it was all part of the magic of the influence of music. And of course, from there, the school, and then I, my first band with my schoolmates, and then, you know, gradually, eventually, I was 18 years old, and my influences from modern music, Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, Beatles, the Yes group.
Uh-huh.
So you have, you know, from England, Jethro Tull, of course, also. And all of that made us a sort of a soup, a combination of that eventually allowed me to express myself. Because nothing is really original. It's all based on what we combine. Mm-hmm. So the art of combining different references in a new way is the merit of the new composer or the new musician. Somehow or other, the way I play piano and the way I conceive music was attractive to me, to my parents, to the friends of my parents. Practically, at least once every 15 days, my father had a social event at his house where he had, you know, they were eating and they were drinking and they were feasting, but something was missing. Oh,
the soundtrack.
So they go and they wake me up late at night just to show off that, look at my son, he can play piano. And I say, oh my God, I hate it. But, yeah. Well, anyways, all that is part of the beginning of my music career.
Thank you for sharing. And yeah, I can see also how I appreciate many things you say. One of them, I didn't want to interrupt you when you mentioned this idea of, in one sense, as a musician, and I myself, not of your caliber, but I'm a musician and I played drums in my teenage years and then learned guitar and bass and now harmonium and mridanga, and I studied tabla. So there is some also ear for music. And your point, and okay, in one sense, what we bring as a musicians or composers is big part of the result of the combined influences of the things we've received. And there's this expression, French expression, that is bricolage. That is basically that. It's like, and I heard recently a podcast of a Sufi theologian on another direction, but he was speaking on bricolage as the real mark of a genius is not necessarily creating something absolutely new out of nothing, but putting together things that already exist in a new way, in a very unique way, tasteful way.
The art of combination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was thinking also regarding your music, how you were prepared for music even without making it a conscious choice, how probably music was already preparing you for a life of devotion, right? Where music is so central, you know, in our bhakti tradition, sound, music, not only central in terms of our practice of kirtan, but even in our philosophy, we will say, as you were saying before also, that even when you are not hearing music, you're hearing music, and I totally understand it. But then I was thinking, but according to our philosophy and even according to contemporary science, they will say in every atom there is frequency and vibrations. So we could even now say there is music all around, right? The whole universe is vibrating in a certain frequency. So there's song and dance everywhere. So that's part of our philosophy. So I was just thinking how music could have laid the ground, the foundation for a life of bhakti, where, again, sound is such a central element. I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, I still remember the first time that I heard a kirtan that was in Israel, 1970. Mm-hmm. Then I met this devotee that, well, I owe you that explanation. But when I heard the first time the Mahamantra, just heard it, I didn't even knew the mantra. Mm-hmm. For me, it was a new sound. There was not a single hair in my body that was not on end. Mm-hmm. My emotions were genuine. I was mesmerized by the experience. Mm-hmm. I still remember the devotee who actually I met. His name is Dinesh Chandra. He was sent by Srila Prabhupada to preach in Israel, and I was happened to be there trying to find what is life all about. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I want to hear.
Sorry, this was in which year, approx?
In 1970.
Okay.
Yeah. He asked me if I want to hear. Do you want to hear my spiritual master? What happened is that Dinesh was the first one to record the earlier recordings of Prabhupada's classes and bhajans. Hmm. Before Krishna Kanti took over.
Okay.
In Los Angeles. So he had a collection of 7.5-inch tapes, you know, those, uh-huh. You know, yeah. So I said, yes, I would like to hear it. I'd like to hear him. And then he put headphones on my head, and suddenly I hear, Andeham Sri Guru. Uh-huh. I had to take my headphones out of my head.
It was too much.
It impacted me so strongly. I think that was, you know, the bij, the seed that mm-hmm. changed my life. Mm. Just to hear Prabhupada chanting in this way.
Beautiful. And I'll go in a minute. I want to go in a minute about your first meeting with devotees and your personal experience with Prabhupada. But let me stay. Let's stay for a few moments more in the world of sound and music, in connection to all this, of course. Everything is interconnected. But
very well.
I'm thinking that, as musicians, we know that music is not just sound, but there is so much in it, right? Not just
emotional sound.
It's an experience and longing, as you were just explaining how somatic that was. I was affecting your whole system, especially sacred sound. So I'm wondering how, as a musician and as a bhakta, as a devotee, how do you experience God, the divine, through music in ways that are even beyond music, that are beyond words? That, for example, I don't know, do you feel that there is a difference between playing music for Krishna and allowing Krishna to play through you, so to say, which is your personal inner experience when you are in that moment?
I don't know if I can define it.
Yeah.
What I can say is that I have developed a capacity, thanks to Krishna, I develop a capacity to compose melodies around the Mahamantra. Mm-hmm. And those melodies, they soothe my heart, and I have seen that it does soothe the heart of my listeners also. Somehow or other, the combined effort of my conditioning, my hearing, the music, my parents, so on and so forth, the influences that I had, somehow or other, when I go into a... And sometimes it happens in a car, I am driving in a car. Oh, let me give you this example. Mm-hmm. When my mother was in the deathbed in Israel, she was accompanied by two other people who were there in their bed. There was no privacy in her case, but she was about to leave her body. And I don't know how, I just came and started to sing, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And I repeat that like 10 times.
That melody came to you at that moment?
At that moment. And at that moment, I just went from one note to another in a spontaneous way. And my intention was to generate this impression on my mother and let her go with this impression to the next destiny. Now, curiously enough, I did a work, it's called Symphony of the Soul. And in Symphony of the Soul, there is that melody. Mm-hmm. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And I don't see so much that Krishna is singing within me, or I don't have that type of perception. Mm-hmm. I can only say that the melodies that I sing, that I compose and sing, and of course that I also sing from others, they generate an impression in my heart and in my mind and in my emotion. And I like to share that with the devotees. Mm.
Fair enough. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Regarding music and regarding the devotional world, I remember a few days ago, from the day we are recording this episode, I did a record with Bali, as I told you, and of course he's also a musician, and we were talking about how our tradition, how the original founders of our tradition were dancers and musicians and poets and mystics, and I don't know, even some of the main books of our tradition, like Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu of Rupa Goswami, is crafted out based on another treatise, the Natya Shastra, which is a whole book of aesthetics. So it's a very aesthetic tradition, very mystical, lots of feeling, lots of creative expression. And of course, personally, I think there is big responsibility for artists in caring with the tradition and allowing the tradition to remain vibrant and alive and human. But also I see sometimes that some practitioners, members of the tradition, struggle with this tension between artistic freedom, because you require some freedom to be creative, and devotional, let's call it devotional correctness, right? What it means to be a proper devotee. So sometimes, I don't know, there may be I feel in some cases, I'm not pointing to any particular individual or group, but sometimes it happens we may be too narrow in our living our tradition, and we overpackage it and put it in a box, and this is what it means to be a devotee, and it is what you should do, what you shouldn't do. And we label certain artistic creative expressions as, I don't know, Maya or independent thinking or mental speculation, and we may stop trusting our inner heart, so to say. So I'm curious, considering all of this, and seeing that you are very, in my opinion, a very balanced person in this sense. So how have you navigated your own life as a Vaishnava and as an artist? You know, how the two are feeding, nourishing each other, I think.
Well, that is a very nice question, and I appreciate it. Since I met Krishna consciousness has been the center of my life. Even though I went through blood, sweat, and tears during my, my devotional career. somehow or other, the conditioning was very strong. Traumas are there from childhood. The necessity of expression was there to express myself. But in once I decided to express myself, I did what George Harrison did in some of his songs. When he sings something in the way she moves, and we understand that that is a composition that is 100% spiritual, but nobody knows, it's a secret. So my songs are love songs, but they are love songs between the soul and God, between the soul and Krishna. And either Krishna is singing or the soul is singing.
Yeah.
For example, there's one song, it's called Marea de la Mar, which means the tide of the sea. So the first line is, sentémonos un rato a conversar. Let's sit down and discuss this. Let's discuss this. Ya no vale la pena. Yeah, there's no need to. It's useless to the way we are relating to each other.
Okay.
Now that can be coming from the soul to Krishna, or from Krishna to the soul. Say, come on, you know, I'm giving you this. So, practically, some of my songs are based on social interaction, but most of my songs, especially my love songs, are related to Krishna. And it's amazing because I can be in front of 2,000 or 20,000 people and I know what I'm singing, but they don't. And to whom
we are revealing the secret today after so many years.
Well, I have to admit that I have done in Spanish also at one interview that I opened that door.
Okay.
But in a way, I feel that in my career was based on kirtan, because I am glorifying the Lord.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioned, they give the example of George Harrison, because of course one of the bands that I loved to listen in my teenage years were the Beatles, among different types of music. And then, of course, George Harrison in his solo career, especially becoming a Vaishnava myself and getting to know about his affinity with Krishna and Prabhupada. And I remember listening first time to his album, Living in the Material World, which is one of my favorites. And it's, in one sense, almost all of the songs are like love songs, or most of them. But one knows, okay, he's a devotee, and you can have the feeling between the lines he's actually singing to Krishna, but most people may listen to those songs and translate them in another way into their own case, which is fine. I'm not criticizing that, but...
He was much more upfront.
Yeah. You know? But even those who were not as direct, that were like, okay, this could be interpreted in different ways. I appreciated the genius of doing that, because you leave the field open and allows for people to relate to the song in whatever way they are or they feel. But also, it's, if you are curious enough, you will wonder, but from where is the author singing that song? From which place of his heart? So,
yeah.
So in that connection, of course, you as a musician and as an artist, an important question I always mention. You are, let's put it this way, sorry to say, but you're a famous person. I casually put a video, I checked a video, I put your artistic name or secular and Elon Chester in YouTube. And just the first video that appeared, it had like 42 million views, which basically like every single inhabitant from the country I'm born, Argentina, saw the video. It's like... That's a big number, let's put it that way.
So, that reminds me, my father, he had a good sense of humor. He used to say, I have told you a million times not to exaggerate.
That's a good one. So yeah, the classical question to well-known people is that what has, and you are famous, but also you are, again, a Vaishnava, where qualities like humility and other qualities are important. And we learned that fame is one of the main qualities accompanying Bhagavan, supreme fame, supreme beauty, supreme this and that. So I don't think fame is necessarily bad. God himself has fame and he's doing well with that. Of course, he's who he is. But yeah, it's a quality that we need to coexist with. And even if, I mean, I'm not at all as famous as you, but even if you are a public person and some people knows you, you can also get caught, even if one person knows you, you can get caught in that in the wrong way and you can have millions of followers. And,
oh, I have, out of that movie, I have a collection.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of the blood, sweat and tears you referred to before.
Yes, indeed.
But in brief, yeah, my question will be, what has public visibility taught you about yourself, both the liked and maybe the difficult parts as well?
Well, I guess that my daughter Dania would answer that in a more clinical way.
Okay.
But I believe that my necessity to have attention, mm-hmm, and affection and recognizing that I am alive and
like being
that
seen.
I exist.
Like being seen and having your existence validated.
Yes, in the house, that was very difficult. My parents, mm-hmm, are coming from very difficult situation. They survived the Second World War and the Holocaust, mm-hmm, by a fraction of a second. You know, mm-hmm, most of their siblings and cousins and aunts and, you know, they all were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with somebody who is affected that way? In fact, those who are expert in human behavior have came to the conclusion that at least three generations are going to be affected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I needed to be listened to. I had a lot to say. The music spoke loud.
Mm.
And it worked. Somehow or other, I managed. Krishna made the arrangement. I understand that.
Mm. I appreciate you. Yeah, you are able to connect. And first of all, to be honest about, okay, I needed to be seen. I needed to have attention. Being honest about, I have that need. I cannot just push that away. But also connect that in a way that is not like fostering more trauma to you, so to say, like, oh, I'm so bad, I want to be seen, I'm such a self-centered guy, but understand it from a healthy perspective that I didn't receive that from my parents, and even it's not their fault in one sense, because they're coming with their own load of trauma.
Yes.
So it's not them to blame, it's not me to blame either. Again, the blame game is not necessary, it's just I needed to be seen, to feel my existence validated, and it took the form of this, and it worked, as you say. So I'm happy that's the case. But yeah, I'm happy to hear you saying all the things, because again, you are, I think, in your 70s now, so you're an elder for the community, and many people may look up to devotees like you, and I think it's very healing to see that warriors like you, soldiers like you, come with their wounds in battle. And it's not like their spiritual journey is like absolute and perfect and there is no trauma, no dysfunctionality. But because if that will be so ideal and perfect, we couldn't relate to that, right? Like it will be too perfect. So I cannot see myself reflected in the journey of the other person. So yeah, seeing your bearing witness to your own journey, I think is very, very healing to everyone. So thank you for that.
Jaya, thank you.
So go into your, I mean, we have been talking about, of course, your side as a spiritual practitioner. I don't want to say, call that a side. And you're a musician on this side and a spiritual practitioner on this side. It's all one. But focusing in your bhakti journey even more, again, you have been practicing bhakti probably, by now for more than half a century. So that's something. I'm not even half a century myself, so my pranam to your more than half a century of bhakti practice. And I've heard from a bird nearby, let's put it that way, that you are a very good storyteller. if you could share with us how you first, I mean, you briefly referred to that, listening to the devotees singing the kirtan, but yeah, how you first came in contact with the bhakti tradition.
Yeah, that story is very fascinating to me.
Give us a trailer of your memoir, basically. One chapter of the memoir.
So in 1970, I decided to go to Israel. I was part of a band at 18 years old. It was a very successful band in Venezuela.
Okay.
But I was living alone in a room of a collective house, sharing bathrooms, and it was heavy. And I left my parents, I left my house to do this. I was playing also in a piano bar.
Okay.
And I was hired by the owner because I used to sing in English. I could sing in English. Well, the song that I was singing when I was tested was "You Got a Friend" by Carole King. When you're down and trouble and you need a helping hand and nothing is going right, I changed the lyric and I put just keep your head to, you know, what was that? When you're down in trouble and you need them all, nothing is gonna, and you just call up his name, and you know wherever you are, he'll come running. I changed the words without having any spiritual experience, but I felt that this was like that. So I went to Israel, and when I went to, when I, in one of the days that I stayed there, there was one neighbor and a very good friend, Salomon. And Salomon, he was living near the University of Tel Aviv, and I every now and then I went to visit him. And one of those days, somebody knocked the door, and I went to open the door. I stayed with him that night. When I opened the door, I find a very thin and tall person, young, with long hair. And he identified himself. He said his name is Roberto. He's coming from India. And he understand that this is a Latin house here, and then next day he was going to Argentina. He's from Argentina, so he wanted to see if we could give him shelter, and we said yes, of course, no problem. He had his own sleeping bag and so on, but the guy was very particular. He was very he was a strange person, not a normal person. And he took the guitar and he started to sing with a guitar that we had there. And it was very folky, very Northern England, Ireland. And I went, what is that? I couldn't believe the talent he had. And at that point, I was really curious to find out, who is this guy? Well, to make a long story short, we went to the roof. And I still remember the amount of stars that were above us. And he was talking about truth and reality, but everything in simile and metaphor. And that bothers me. Because, I mean, if you're going to talk something straightforward and let me know what you have to say. And don't decorate too much for me because my brain is not so developed. So I got sort of angry and I said, okay, what is truth? What is reality? And he said, oh, I know that my hands are made of water and cannot grasp anything. But one day, the seed of the tree of eternity will give fruits, the fruit of love of God, the sweetest of all tastes. And I went, what?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand anything. I said, you know what? This guy is a little bit too complicated. Let's go to sleep. And yes, it was already at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm. So we went to sleep. So I was in one bed, Solomon was in his bed, and he was in his sleeping bag. And I don't know why, out of curiosity, I asked him, Roberto, do you do yoga?
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down with wide eyes and he said, yes, bhakti yoga, but don't ask me anything else.
Mm.
And I went, okay. I mean, he could have said anything, and it, you know, what is bhakti? I have no idea. I don't even know what yoga is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why I ask, but I thought, you know, he's coming from India. Anyways, next day, he was gone. He was gone because he had to take an airplane to Argentina.
Mm.
So I decided to go to visit my grandmother. And when I'm going to visit my grandmother, I have to go to the station, to the bus station. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and the bus is not coming. Oh, of course not. It's Saturday. And in Israel, the public transportation is limited only to taxis. Okay, so I started walking towards the main street in order to get a taxi to go to my grandma's house. And I see a kiosk, and that kiosk has games and magazines and sweets and all type of things, you know, small things, newspapers. But one particular image really caught my eye. And I was looking at this cover of this magazine, and I opened the magazine, and then I see somebody who is bald-headed with a sikha, and I started to read in my third class Hebrew that Krishna is God. Oh my God, another name, another tradition. Mm-hmm. I was not familiar with this one. Anyway, I went on reading, and he was explaining the goal of life and the Bhagavad Gita and all of that. And then suddenly he says,
bhakti yoga.
Bhakti yoga. Yes.
There you have it.
And when he says bhakti yoga, I couldn't resist.
Mm.
I went, instead of going to my mother, I went to the house of this gentleman who was interviewing this magazine. He was in Israel.
Mm.
One detail is that when I was left with it from the taxi near the house, there were like 100 meters, maybe 200 meters actually. I ran towards the house with emotion. I didn't. It's like if I'm going to see my mother that I haven't seen her for 50 years or something. I was like, something was very powerful. I knocked the door, and what do I see? I see somebody open the door and says, Hare Krishna. And I go, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Please come in. So coming in, and then the smell of the incense and the spices,
it's a unique smell of this whole thing combined. It's its own bricolage again.
and then the pictures on the wall. I couldn't resist. Who is that? Is it blue or black? But he has a flute. Who is he? He said, "Oh, that is Krishna." And who is Krishna? He said, "Oh, Krishna is God." What? You mean that person is God? Yes. With complete conviction.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's curious. You don't
like things complicated, right? So he made it very simple, right? Yeah, he's God. Yeah.
Everybody is looking for God under in the moon, under the earth, and religions and science, and you having hanged in your wall. That was too much to handle. And then he said, "Come and see I'm doing a short version." He said, "Come and see the temple," and I said, "Temple, altar." That was not acceptable. You know, the Jewish
kind of from a tradition. Jewish background, yeah.
And he gave obeisances, and I stood up, and then I saw the five figures with an extended hand, and
yeah,
I didn't understand anything.
Not even one, but five.
Right.
You survived very well your first meeting, huh?
Well, I was open-minded. I was very careful also because I knew I wanted to know the truth, but I didn't want to get hypnotized or brainwashed.
Yeah.
So I was very careful. But once I read the book he gave me Krishna Consciousness, the topmost system of yoga.
Yeah.
It was a color red, and I fell in love with it. The second time that
the whole thing started with the word yoga from Roberto, right? And then you received the book
thinking about yoga. Yes. Yeah, it was the continuation. You're right. So next time that I came, I didn't have a telephone. I mean, there was no telephone at that time. I come in, and that's the time when he actually showed me the recording of Srila Prabhupada chanting Vandeham. But at the same time, I saw that plates of prasadam, of food, and they were running from the kitchen to the altar, from the kitchen to the altar. And there were a lot of preparations. So I asked, "Wow, what is this?" He says, "Well, today we are celebrating the birth of Lord Chaitanya."
Okay.
So it was Gaur Purnima. So now I'm going to ask you, just guess how many people were there. You tell me.
Maybe only you.
Yes. You're right.
Yeah.
I was the only
guest.
The only guest. Therefore,
you have to finish the 108 preparations.
at least 30.
Okay.
And among them halava, which that was enough. Just with halava was enough.
Yeah.
What, it's samosa?
Okay.
Kachori?
Yeah.
And sweet rice and sabji?
Yeah.
That was it. Everything became much more understandable from that moment on.
Yeah.
So that's the way it happened. Then my father, he asked me to leave the country because the war was starting. He knew it. And he didn't want me to stay in Israel. So I had the books, the original books, the Macmillan Bhagavad Gita of Srila Prabhupada, the blue one.
Yeah.
And I had the short versions of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. And in this way, I arrived in Venezuela and I started to speak to my friends and to my colleagues. And this is the beginning of my spiritual career. Then eventually devotees came, Chitsukananda, Hanuman, Srivas, Satyajit, you know, I discovered them. They were singing in one street. I was coming from rehearsals, and suddenly I heard, I ran to see them. And then from there, well, eventually I was part of the yatra. Then I opened the temple in Colombia in 1975. I was initiated in 1973 in Los Angeles, along with some of my devotees.
Tell me, how was your first meeting in person with Srila Prabhupada?
Well, the first time that I saw him,
which was in 73, right? There?
In 73, yeah. Yes. It was at the moment that you hear the voice singing, Govinda Madhipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. The curtains are open and Srila Prabhupada entered. That was the first time that I saw him personally. And I heard the class. And after that, I said, I know he's going to walk. So I had to go with him to the morning walk. Somehow or other, I found one empty space in one of the cars, and I didn't think twice. I just sat down, and I ended up being in a park walking with Srila Prabhupada. At that point, I was right behind him, but I couldn't dare to, because I see the other devotees talking to him in a natural way, in a spontaneous way. I didn't dare to call his name because I was very shy and it's too much. But still, I got some courage and I said, Srila Prabhupada. And he stopped walking and he turned to see me. And I got paralyzed and he said, yes. And he goes, Srila Prabhupada, you gave me the name Javi, but I don't know what the meaning of the word Javi is. So he didn't understand me well, so he turned to Karandar and he said, Javi, what is this? Oh, I think it had to do something with butter. Somebody told me something about, Javi. Is Brahmahavir is the ghee that you use in fire sacrifice. And then since I got a little confident, I decided to call him again and ask him why, because if he can please come to Caracas, to Venezuela. And he said, he asked me how many inhabitants were there. I didn't know exactly, so I was very nervous. But this is the first encounter. But I had another one in 1976, when, as a president of the Temple of Colombia, I decided to go to, it was an excuse to buy mirdangas and cartas and dhotis and like that.
Whatever need to be bought for you to be there.
So here I am in Mayapur, and Prabhupada says, here I am in Mayapur, and Prabhupada was calling the leaders. So I was with Hridayananda Maharaj. And with Panchadravida Swami. And we heard that clearly Prabhupada wants to talk to the leaders. So I went hey, I am a President Temple of of Colombia. I just wanted to see Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.
I ran. I practically ran. And I went up to the floor where Prabhupada was staying, and I came the first one, and I gave my obeisances, and I was, and then I lift my head to see him, and he was just looking at his hands. Just looking at his hand. He was full of mustard oil with the gamcha, that's it. And then I was paralyzed because he was moving so slow and looking at his hand and lifting his head, moving the head from one place to another in an elegant way. But he was like a Hamsa, an inhabitant of another realm. That's the way I saw him. But I was afraid also because I know that I am not one of the leaders. So the leaders are going to come any moment and they're going to say, Javi, can you wait outside? So to avoid that, I went to the corner of the room and I sat there. And here I am by myself with Srila Prabhupada. He's sitting behind his desk. And I'm sitting in a corner and I cannot blink. I'm just looking at him. And here is he continuing looking at his hand and bringing it back. Meanwhile, the leaders came. And lo and behold, they were sitting in front of Srila Prabhupada doing exactly what I was doing, just watching. Just watching Prabhupada, and Prabhupada looking at his hand. And at one point he said, so what did they say? And the President Temple of New York said, well, they say we're brainwashing Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada said, we're not brainwashing, we're brain giving.
Yeah.
And that's the famous
Then
line.
We can talk about washing, because first you have to have something to wash.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm.
And then, yes, because there was a whole thing about the middle class and also the Jewish community was, they were afraid, you know, their kids are running away.
Yeah, yeah.
So suddenly the light was off because the somehow or other, you know, Mayapur in 1976. Yeah. Who was it? I don't remember this woman. They brought two lamps, Bhavananda.
Mm-hmm.
He brought two lamps, one, you know, lamps with kerosene lamp, with a little movement of light.
Yeah.
And then he put it on each side of Prabhupada. And the whole atmosphere became even more mystical. Because, you know, when you have light like we have now on top of us, it's like light, you know, just shower of light. There's nothing is organic in that light. But when you have that light with just flames, two flames, moving in that atmosphere in the evening, it's impossible to convey that experience. That was the last time I saw Srila Prabhupada, because he left in 1977.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing those beautiful remarks, and I'm sure you will be able to convey them even more beautifully in the memory you are already writing. I'm sure all that will be there. So thank you for giving us a trailer of that. And I'm thinking also, Javi Prabhu, and you mentioned that the very first years of your joining Krishna consciousness, you spent some years living as a monk in the temple, and then again, you became a musician, a famous musician. So many things happened almost 5 decades in between. So I'm curious about how you will describe the evolution of, as I like to call it, your Bhakti project, right? Our life project is Bhakti. So how, looking back 50 years ago, which had been some major signposts or highlights along the journey? And again, it's a long journey. So just if you want to share whatever you may...
Well, I can say how I ended up. I am at this moment speaking to you from Mayapur.
Mm-hmm.
I had conflicting thoughts about how to deal with my last stage in life. I am going to be 73 years old, and it's about time to dedicate the time that I have left to use all the time and all the effort that I honestly can apply, mm-hmm, in terms of preparing for the last experience of death. So I am lucky to be coached by Vaisheshika Prabhu, who I told him that I cannot live without him. And also I have friends like Niranjana Maharaj and others. You know, I'm so lucky that I can come and reveal my mind, my heart, and I can feel loved the way I feel. So I'm grateful, and I'm waiting for a keyboard that is arriving soon. I'd like to take this keyboard. It's a small one, just 37.
Okay.
Keys. But it sounds fantastic, and I'm going to program it. If I can take that to Russia, to China, wherever, mm-hmm, you know, I am required or invited. And I'd like to share my emotion and my good fortune that I feel now.
Mm-hmm.
Mayapur is I feel embraced by Mayapur as a holy place, and I'm surrounded by angels in this place. So I cannot be more grateful.
So you mentioned the word angels, and you mentioned the word of how you have friends and well-wishers in your life that make you feel loved. And again, going back to your childhood experience and everything else, that the need to feel loved or to be seen, to be validated by love, ultimately. And I'm currently finishing writing my fourth book, which will be all about unconditional love and how Krishna is already loving us unconditionally. And many times we can experience that through his agents, so to say, and how on that foundation of knowing we are already seen, held, embraced, accepted, loved, we can dare to love back. Because if we don't have that, if we don't see that we are loved already or we are lovable, it may be difficult for us to be loving, to dare to love others, because we don't have a point of reference. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on this idea of on the importance of first, at least for me, the importance of first laying that foundation of you are loved by God, you are loved, you are already valuable and loved, rather than just trying to push, you have to love Krishna, that's the goal. But if I don't feel myself loved, how much can I actually progress in trying to love? How much can I give what I'm not feeling that I'm receiving, so to say?
Well, it's a very refined perception to understand that Krishna is loving us.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens in sadhu sangha, It happens when you chant honestly. It happens when you do kirtan with like-minded persons, devotees. It's a great fortune. Kona bhagyavan jeev. How fortunate is a person. And I have to admit, I don't feel now that I have to find love or that I need attention. I just want to share what I feel, and what I feel is it's beautiful, and I'd like to share beauty.
Speaking about love, a question comes to my mind. What have you learned about love that you could have learned, you could not have learned it any other way in your life? What have you learned about love that you couldn't have learned it any other way?
It's a very complex question.
Okay.
I don't want just answer anything for the sake of answering.
Yeah.
I can say that one of the most important ways I have felt love in my life is in association of devotees who wish me well. And who, like I spoke about Vaisheshika, for example, he's such a busy devotee, and he has so many disciples, and he has so many, but he always finds some time to call me. So that has no, there's no way to understand love any other way. His heart is huge, and his capacity of love, to give love, it just reflects where he's at. Same thing I have experienced with Niranjana and Shivaram and so many devotees, you know, Tara Prabhu here in Mayapur. I feel secure, embraced by the Dhamma and embraced by the devotees. Kona bhagyavan jeev.
In your journey, Habib Prabhu, has your understanding of Krishna changed over the years? Not so much in terms of whether Krishna is real or not, but how Krishna is encountered, how Krishna is felt, how Krishna is experienced.
By reading the Venu Gita of Shivaram Swami, which, by the way, I fell in love with that book. I financed the translation to Spanish.
Okay.
By an Argentinian devotee she's extremely talented. And she did a great job, and I decided to narrate the book. I have already narrated half of it. It has taken time, but it's such a joy. That book is so revealing. How can you be in the spiritual world when you are narrating, you are hearing what you're narrating, and you are reading at the same time? So all the senses and all your consciousness is invested in that activity.
So that has given some interesting dimension of relating to Krishna.
That's my answer. I mean, because it's there, Shabda Brahman, there's no difference. Yes, the feelings are there. It's not sahaja. It's something that, because you apply your senses, because you sit down and you do your job correctly, then you feel the reciprocation.
Yeah. So you were mentioning just now that you were working on a translation for this work in Spanish, and both of us have a Latin American background. And I remember in one of our conversations, more than one of our conversations, we have been spoken about how to keep the flow of Krishna Bhakti flowing in a generous way to the Latin American communities that sometimes, at least, if I'm not mistaken, you've shared with me that you felt sometimes some sections of the Latin American communities were a little bit on the margins in terms of support or resources. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about how that could be improved or nourished, or from your side, how you feel that particular call to nourish Latin America.
Well, I have to admit that those who really dedicated their time to do the best they can, in the case of Virabhu Prabhu and Guru Prasad Maharaj, and others who came with the idea of having a solid yatra, my highest respect. We all did the best we could, mm-hmm. and somehow or other, I have issues that I don't know if it's proper, but at least I will dare, if you don't mind. We are organized in a way, we did organize ourselves in a way that we were very ambitious, we were very enthusiastic, we want to save the world. Okay, now we have 7-8 countries, mm-hmm. But how are you going to manage this? How are you going to manage 8 different yatras? You will have to come because we have seen those who have success in their project is because they stay. Mm-hmm. Just stay there and work and train and don't go. The problem is that if he stays too long, then the other 7 yatras are neglected. Mm-hmm. They feel like then they're not attended properly. So it's something that, damn if you do, damn if you don't. So we have to find a solution. How do we do this? We have 10,000 years to figure this out.
Hopefully more even. We may need even more than that, but let's see. Yeah, we are all trying to do whatever we can. But yeah, I agree with you that in my personal case, I've been my first 20 years mostly living in Argentina, and all the things that I was sharing was in Spanish, and somehow the doors to the English-speaking world opened, and I already knew English from my childhood, and now most of the sharing and things I'm doing are in English, and somehow there is this little guilt voice in my head like, do not forget South America, do not forget your roots. And I'm trying not to do so, but yeah, it's always a dance, a struggle to keep the balance and not feel anyone neglected and nourished as much as, and also acknowledge your own capabilities of attending to certain number of people, because we have our limits as well, right? Yeah. When you look at younger generations, Javi Prabhu, approaching Bhakti today, younger generation, what gives you hope and what concerns you?
I somehow have a mixed feeling. Mm-hmm. But
that's why I made a mixed question also.
No, but it's a good one because I have to admit that I have encountered very beautiful new devotees. I mean, people who have, they are, between 20 and 30 years old, and and they're dynamic. They really want to preach. They really want to. They fell in love, and I don't blame them because Krishna consciousness is a good reason to fall in love with. But I see that maybe they could learn from our immaturity, because we didn't have, we just went as we could. But now they can have good advice from us, from our mistakes, and also from our success in doing things for Prabhupada.
Mm. So you are speaking about new generations learning from the elders' mistakes, which I totally appreciate that. So I'm wondering, again, you have been practicing for more than 50 years. Now you are in your 70s. So is there anything that, looking back, you will do differently? Or you will do the same, looking back at your devotional development in your career?
I once asked that question to Hridayananda Maharaj.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if I could bring the tape back,
mm-hmm.
I would record something different.
Mm-hmm.
I can say the same thing. Of course, if I had more intelligence, if I was not if I could have been not so dysfunctional in my upbringing, maybe I could have been more productive and be more useful for Prabhupada movement. But this, you know, as McCartney used to sing, we do in the best that we can.
Wow. It's getting better all the time.
Yeah.
Even with messiness included, right? But yeah, I like the it gives hope. It's getting better all the time, even when, yeah. Yeah, so I appreciate that because, again, of course, we cannot go back. We cannot change the tape of the past, and we are invited to embrace and accept whatever had to happen. But at the same time, there are younger generations. So whatever we cannot change in our past, at least we can help others to prevent going through certain avoidable experiences by sharing our own experience to them.
Yeah. Yes. They become our kids,
mm-hmm.
and we want the best for them.
Yeah. After, again, messiness, but also a lot of success in your life. I wonder what does success mean? The word success mean to you now, and maybe how that is different from how you interpreted or success in your early life.
Well, I went through it through fame and material success and recognition and honors and so on. And that's very sweet. It has a sweet, but also, you know, when you are honored by an academy that uses hamburger and liquor sponsors,
mm-hmm.
why am I part of that? Why, you know, and then, you know, when I started in my career, I started in a theater, and people were nicely dressed, and they coming to hear music. And I was happy in that environment. But now, you know, if I started when I was 28 to 30 years old, now I'm, you know, my followers, they had 5 years.
They were 5 years younger than you.
Younger than me, or 3 years, or 10 years. That means that if I'm 73, they must be 68. Uh-huh. You know, they don't want now to go to a theater. They prefer to have with a vodka and a whiskey,
uh-huh.
Sitting, reminiscing their past. And that, of course, those who are the business side of it, the empresarios, they hire me to come out at 11 o'clock and they invite the public to come at 8 or 9
uh-huh.
so that when I come out, they already drank for 2 hours.
Yeah. You have a good, cheerful audience, for sure.
Well,
if they haven't fall asleep or drunk or whatever.
No, it's incoherence. Mm-hmm. It, suddenly you become, what am I doing here?
Mm.
You know, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. Well, enough is enough.
Mm. So since you are happy and you're about to be 73, what feels most alive for you right now in this season of your life, in your Auntie Ali life, we may dare to call it that way?
Well, to finish the book,
yeah.
I want to chant the holy name as much as I can, either in form of japas and kirtan, and share the melodies that I have composed, and make happy people, because there's nothing that makes me more happy than making people happy.
Mm. Mm. Any approximate date of when the book may be published, or you're taking your time writing it? No deadline, no rush.
Well, I'm ashamed to say, but my inconsistencies are still there. I'm not, this is my first effort in a book.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I go slowly but surely.
Beautiful. And one last question, if you allow me, in your unique personal case.
Please.
What are the fruits of more than 50 years of practice of bhakti?
A softy heart, a heart who is soft, and extremely grateful and very fortunate. I mean, it is evident that we are fortunate. I mean, what we have received, this treasure, you know, it's so beautiful. Then, yes, from the side of the feelings, or the side of the emotions, the side of knowledge, the side of kids that I had, and my relationship with the mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I am extremely grateful. Well, we still have some years to go.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Before we end, Javi Prabhu, is there anything else you would like to share, to leave with our listeners?
Well, I want to let everybody know that I have developed love for you.
Oh.
And that you represent a generation that can be humble, wise, considerate. I mean, there's so many good qualities. I wish you well. Your situation is not at all easy, because in a way you are by yourself.
Mm. In a way, yeah. In another way, there's so much support for all wishers. Yeah.
No, you have support for the but yes, I mean it. An institutional situation is uncertain, but
I'm fine with that. I've never been an institutional person, so I'm totally fine with that, just in case.
Well, we need you.
Yeah, and I need all of you, so I need you, and thank you for being there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us in today's conversation. Really appreciate it, Javi Prabhu. Looking forward to our next crossing paths in person soon, hopefully.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.